This is Chatter. I'm Shane Harris. This week, historian Vince Houghton on how the Cold War made Miami.
The only reason Miami is what it is today is because of national security concerns, and primarily because of intelligence, right? The CIA built Miami. Castro, you don't always think about him as this master of propaganda and information operations. He's this, you know, despotic dictator who throws people in prison for political reasons, but he is a genius when it comes to using immigration and exile as a weapon against the United States. Every single asset we thought we had in Cuba for over 20 years was actually working for Castro the whole time. The Cubans were pound for pound the best intelligence agency that's ever stepped on the planet.
Vince Houghton, welcome back to Chatter. You're a repeat guest. It's great to see you.
It's great to be here, Shane. Thanks.
You have like behind you, listeners can't see this, but there is like a wheel with the National Security Agency logo on it and an array of letters of the alphabet. Is this like a big blow up of like an Enigma rotor or something?
So this is a blow up of a very traditional cipher wheel created about 500 years ago. So not quite as advanced as Enigma, but it's really appropriate kind of behind me because of my current job.
Yes, yes. Which for those who don't know, Vince is the director of the National Cryptologic Museum at the National Security Agency, which unlike your counterpart at the CIA is open to the public.
Yeah, we're the only museum in the entire intelligence community that's completely open to the public. So we have additional responsibilities because of that, but we also have a lot more fun than our friends at CIA.
Do you ever get like any like weird Russians or Chinese like shady looking operatives coming through the museum?
Every so often there are people we give a little side eye to, but you know, everything here is completely declassified, so they can look at whatever they want to. Hopefully we intimidate the bad guys, right? They come here and be like, this is the stuff they have on display. Yeah.
I had a very fun experience, I think when you gave me a tour some years ago, where there was an exhibit of something that had been declassified. It was not declassified when I spent a few years trying to report it and research it for a book that I published. So that was really cool to be like, oh, we can talk about this thing now. But that is not why you're here today. We are not going to be talking about, we may talk a little bit about cryptology, but not really. We're going to talk about spying and covert operations of a different sort. We're here to talk about your new book, which you co-wrote with Eric Driggs, called Covert City, The Cold War, and the Making of Miami. And if anybody is hoping that the cover of this book would be like an evocative Miami Vice-style nightscape with the palm tree and a skyline, it is. It's exactly that. It is from the minute you look at this book, you're like, oh, wow, cool. All right, we're going to hear a story about a city that I feel like when I saw this book, I'm like, oh yeah, well this kind of makes sense because you know it's Miami, it's the CIA, Cuba, Castro, whatever. And so like that was like my initial toehold onto this. But the more I thought about it, I was like, wow, I guess I'm thinking like, you know, drug running and shady operatives in, you know, South Florida through the Cold War. All of which say I knew nothing about that, which you cover extensively in the book. But it kind of like when I saw the title of the book, it made me think like, oh God, that's a great idea. Tell us a little bit to start just about your Miami story, because you have a personal connection to the city as well. So let's talk about that before we dig into the book.
Yeah. So both my co-author and I have, you know, grew up in Miami. He was born there. I moved there when I was a year and a half, but my parents were from there. They met at the University of Miami and they just happened to move up to Washington, D.C. like so many of us to work. And that's where I was born. But I consider myself a Miami native. And so is my co-author. And growing up in the 80s in Miami, of course, right in the middle of the drug craziness. But my parents and my co-author's parents grew up in the 60s in Miami. And so they experienced the craziness from a whole different perspective. And that's much more what this book really focuses on. But Eric and I have been talking about writing this for about 15 years. You know, we just kind of would laugh. I mean, we both have great academic credentials. We both work in government agencies. We're both in a position where we can do this from a skill set. You know, it's like, can we find a way to take what might end up being a 900-page book and write it in such a way that people will buy it and read it. And that was the real difficulty here, because there's so many stories of this city. And one of the things I, as an intelligence diplomatic historian, have read hundreds and hundreds of books on the Cold War. It's kind of what you need to do. And every single one of them, I kept looking for stories about my hometown, because so much happened down there that mattered. And if you look at the top, you know, the books that you would be assigned in a graduate level U.S. foreign policy class, if you look at the index, you don't find the word Miami in the index. Maybe in reference to a bunch of Cubans went to Miami, and then you get the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah.
And we thought that was kind of ridiculous. Just knowing what we know about the history of that city, we knew how that was problematic. And so we said, all right, so we're going to write a book. Our big, huge, you know, can we pull this off thesis was going to be that Miami should be regarded, along with Moscow, Washington, Berlin, Beijing, as this Cold War city. I think we pulled that off. But even if we didn't, kind of our secondary thing was to show that Miami as a city is today, right? Everyone kind of, you know, looks at it from Miami Vice or from sports or anything else as this tourist mecca with corruption. I think the last 5 or 6 mayors of Miami were all indicted in a row. It was wonderful. If you kind of love that kind of crazy. Yeah, well, we've taken the mantle. I mean, the mob moved from Chicago to Miami. We've taken the mantle of the corrupt city. So we knew that there was going to be kind of this crazy. But it turns out, and I've known this since I lived there, because all of my parents' friends were government. So they were either ex-CIA or current CIA. And we understood that the only reason Miami is what it is today is because of national security concerns, and primarily because of intelligence, right? The CIA built Miami, and no one was reporting on that. No one was writing about that. Like, how this is a great, you have a major U.S. city that is now millions of people with hundreds of billions of dollars in commerce, and it was built by an intelligence agency. And I'm not exaggerating there. Right? A full 1/3 of Miami's economy in the 1960s was supplied by the CIA. You don't find any other city on earth, right? Maybe Saigon before it fell, you know, to the North Vietnamese. But the Miami we know today is a direct result. And the Miami I grew up in is a direct result of the CIA and foreign policy. And so that's from my perspective. Now, my co-author, Eric, while he has a name that doesn't sound very Hispanic, he is 100% Cuban. Mm-hmm. Both of his parents came over after the Castro Revolution. They settled in Miami. He was born there as the first generation of his family born in the United States. His grandfather was a captain in the Cuban Navy under Bautista and actually ran the Cuban Naval Academy, right? So kind of almost Bautista-era royalty.
Yeah.
And so he has a perspective that's very different than mine. And what's crazy about this book, in my opinion, is Eric and I went to all the same schools. Like, we've known each other since elementary school. Went to all the same schools, had all the same friends, played the same sports, loved the same teams, went to the same church, had the same education, give or take, but did it from an entirely different perspective. Mm. Me as a 14th generation American, a white guy whose father came over in World War II, Eric as a first generation whose parents came over because Castro took their land. And we were able to approach this book in two different directions, which made it, I would argue, way better than it would have been if either of us had written it alone. Because we call each other out. If we weren't such good friends, we would never talk to each other again. Because there were times when we were writing this where I would come at this from a very cynical perspective. Like, oh, this is all pork. The Cubans, you know, are just trying to get money from the government and this and that. And you'd be like, stop. I worked on this program. Right, I worked for Ileana Ross-Leighton when she was developing this program in the 90s. I promise you we were not cynical when we were developing this. Now, in hindsight, it turned out it was a ridiculously stupid program that did no good. But when we were designing it, I promise you we were only thinking about bringing news and information and freedom to Cuba.
Right.
And I was like, all right, I get it. You know, I'm looking at this from the white Miami perspective of this is my tax dollars going to a blimp that flies over the Florida Straits and tries to broadcast information in Cuba. They basically use 1960s era jamming technology to make sure none of that information got into the island. Or we tried to drop modems in hotspots all over the island to spread internet and which the Cubans only use to watch porn. And we spent millions of dollars doing that. And Eric very much said, just stop being, you know, so cynical about this. This was intended to do good.
Yeah.
Turned out bad, but was intended to do good. So we had a lot of conversations like that. And the other way around too, where he's like, I don't think we can say this like this. My parents will be mad at us. You know, and I love his family. I've known them forever. It's like, my parents will not like the way we're doing this. I'm like, Eric, we have to, right? We have to approach this in this way. It's the only way to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, they're especially when we're talking about some of the, and we have to use this word, some of the terrorists that come out of the Cuban exile community that are blowing up airplanes and, you know, and doing things that we have to define as terrorism. And he's like, the Cuban community will hate us for this. I'm like, tough.
Yeah.
Right. That's you. What other word can you use talking about people who put bombs on civilian aircraft and blow them up? Right. It's terrorism.
Yeah.
And so we kept each other honest throughout this. And it's because we've been friends since the early 1980s and we're able to, you know, get in these fights without killing each other.
Right. Right. And really the spirit of that, it's interesting. That's a good background because in the book, what really does come through is that the people that you're writing about, you know, they are true believers. These Cubans who have come to Miami to build a new life, but they have this dream of liberating Cuba from Castro. And there's always the sense that we are on the one hand in Miami, but we are on the other hand sort of like psychically, emotionally in Cuba. And that tension and that dichotomy pulls a lot on them too. And seems to have defined generations of Miamians as well.
Yeah, no question. I mean, I think that you see there's an evolution of mindset that takes place was in the 1960s, most of the Cuban exiles in Miami thought they were there temporarily.
Right.
Right. We're not going to really get roots. We're not going to kind of settle down and become, you know, residents. We're just kind of staying here for a little while until we can raise enough money and enough weapons to go take back Cuba. And I think by the end of the 1960s, 1970s, that begins to change. And a lot of people have kind of a come to Jesus moment saying, this is not happening tomorrow. This is not happening anytime soon. And that's where you really see the transformation of Miami into this kind of multicultural space where you've got Calle Ocho and whole areas of Little Havana where they don't speak English, right? Because it's just set up shop as this transplantation of what people had in Cuba to now parts of Miami. And businesses pop up and banks pop up and it just becomes part of the kind of environment in Miami. It's just, it's part Cuban. And at the same time, you have a really interesting transformation that takes place of those that are part of the first migrant group or the first exile group, almost judging is the wrong word, but having a sense of condescension towards those that come later. Especially in the Mariel Boatlift in 1980. And what Eric does so well is he's been studying this for a long time. He worked at the Cuba Center at the University of Miami. He's worked at Southcom. Is he really couches this in an interesting way. And something that's very much down, you know, right down Broadway when it comes to talking about intelligence, and that's information operations, right? And Castro, you don't always think about him as this master of propaganda and information operations. He's this, you know, despotic dictator who throws people in prison for political reasons. But he is a genius when it comes to using what Eric terms weapons of mass migration, of using immigration and exile as a weapon against the United States.
Yeah.
And Mariel's a great example of this, right? Where he wants to stick it to the United States. So he just kind of sprinkles in people who are released from prisons and insane asylums. And even though there are thousands and thousands of Cubans who hit the ground in Miami in 1980 and want to work hard and make something of themselves, same as people who came over in 1959, what Castro does is he sprinkles in these people who get all the headlines. They're all the people working for the cartels. They're all the people who are the criminals. And so it sours not only white and black Miami on these new Cuban immigrants, but it actually sours the original Cuban exile community against these new Cuban immigrants.
Yeah.
And Castro does this on purpose. And Castro continues to work this information operations thing all the way until the day he dies.
Yeah.
And if you talk about him as being, you know, a cunning leader, maybe, or as a, you know, a reformer, maybe, but you can't argue the fact that he was one of the best we've ever seen at propaganda and information operations. Like, he puts Putin to shame. He puts, you know, the Germans in World War II to shame when it comes to molding a societal response to what you're trying to do, especially as much as he's punching above his weight, right? He's a little dinky country taking on the U.S. and making us fall all over ourselves politically because of the whims of his migration system. It's just genius. I mean, Ilhan Gonzalez is a great example of this. If you want to, you know, we dive into
We'll get to that. Let's go back to the beginning, though, a little bit here, because I want to kind of start people out from a point of understanding kind of when Miami and the Cuban exile community starts to form this alliance with the CIA, because it really is the CIA is really the agency at the heart of the book. And most people will know the ill-fated Bay of Pigs operation and the animosity that that created a lot of the Cuban exile community towards the Kennedy administration. We don't have time to go into all of those things, but just to kind of situate people, give us a sense of kind of what the flavor was in that Cuban community in Miami that first begins forming those connections with the CIA, which will then lead to operations like the Bay of Pigs.
Well, the CIA contingent in Miami when the Castro Revolution takes place was a whopping one person. There was a single individual in Miami working for CIA whose job it was to essentially debrief the Cuban exiles as they came over. Eventually, the agency decides to beef up his contingent into five. He's got, luckily, four Spanish-speaking military guys who are essentially detailed to him to help with this interrogation. As the numbers of Cuban exiles swell, and as it becomes clear that the Castro administration is going to reach out to the Soviets and begin that relationship, the CIA takes things a lot more seriously. Mm-hmm. To the point that within 2 years of the Castro Revolution, and even before that, the CIA station in Miami is the second largest CIA facility in the world.
Goes that fast, yeah.
That fast.
That's huge. Yeah.
Right? So only Langley, the headquarters of CIA, has more resources and more people than the CIA station in Miami. And if you kind of know the CIA's charter, it's not supposed to be domestic.
Right.
Right? You know, you think the Moscow station would be bigger, the Berlin station. No, it's the Miami station. And so when I said earlier that one third of Miami's economy was because of the CIA, it's because you have hundreds of CIA officers on the payroll down in Miami and thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Cuban exiles as contractors on the payroll. And every single one of those people needs housing, furniture, cars, food, movies, bowling, all those things. And so the CIA just dumps hundreds of millions of dollars into the Miami economy. Not only that, the CIA needs to buy training spaces out in the Everglades to train these paramilitary forces, safe houses where they need to change them every so often. There are three or four members of the CIA team down in Miami who just did real estate transactions. Their full-time job was to buy and sell houses and land. And eventually they create a Navy, the Exile Navy, which actually Eric knows very well because his grandfather was a key member of forming the Exile Navy, eventually builds a naval armada that is the third largest navy in the Caribbean. The CIA's navy is the third largest, not only the United States, but the Cuban Navy. And so by 1962, when the Bay of Pigs happens, there is a massive force down there ready to retake Cuba. And so when you look at the Kennedy decision and before the Eisenhower decision, in hindsight, we go, God, this was a disaster. What a stupid, stupid thing to do. If you don't look at it with hindsight of knowing how it ends, you can see why they were somewhat optimistic about this. Now, we're not going to get, there's 100 books on this where you can read about why it collapses and why it doesn't work. It was a Pentagon plan, and then it was a CIA plan, and then it was a Pentagon plan again, and all this thing goes bad. Kennedy withholds air support, all that. But by the time Bay of Pigs ends, all these Cuban exiles come back. They're licking their wounds. Now the realization is there's not going to be an invasion. And that's where the covert stuff really comes into play, where you get Operation Mongoose. You get these operations that are outside of the government control to the point where the U.S. government is actually starting to say, hey, you're doing too much here, right? We need to actually curtail your operations. And what we show in the book, I think, which is really, really interesting, is where these Cuban exiles who no longer are training to invade Cuba can now be used by CIA to do other things, to go into the Congo, to go into Bolivia and other places, especially Vietnam, right? The contingent of Cuban exiles who become special operators in Vietnam or helicopter pilots, it per capita is a massive number, right? It's just people who are looking for ways to help fight communism anywhere they can.
And you mentioned Operation Mongoose. Just briefly remind people what that was, because that's another one that looms in the lore of 60s era Miami.
I think one thing that's going to get some minor pushback from, you know, people like Max Boot and others who have written about Edward Lansdale is I argue Operation Mongoose is more lore than reality. It has a lot of people who point to it as kind of showing America was, during that time period, was devious and kind of the bad guy. And I argue, sure, the ideas behind Mongoose were horrendous. It included things like Operation Northwoods, which was creating a pretext for an invasion of Cuba by blowing up a plane flying from Miami to Washington, or actually creating terrorist attacks in Miami and other places and blaming on the Cuban government, or attacking Guantanamo ourselves and pretending it was the Cubans, or blowing up an American ship and having a remember the main moment to try to create an impetus. The crazy thing about Mongoose is you can read all these plans and they are absolutely nuts and ridiculous. And they do make us look really bad. But then if you take a step back and realize we didn't do any of them, right? These were just the ideas of a relatively unstable man, Edward Lansdale, and some high-level people within the Pentagon who thought it was fun to come up with these really wacky, out-of-the-blue plans that never saw the light of day. The actual irony behind Operation Mongoose is the schedule that was planned out by Lansdale would have had Mongoose going into full, you know, operational mode in October of 1962. And if you know your basic history of what happened in October 1962, you know that is not a time when Mongoose is going into operation. It's a time when we're busy trying not to all die because of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then, of course, the resulting end of the Cuban Missile Crisis is a pledge of non-intervention, that we are not going to allow anyone to invade Cuba. And Mongoose ends before it even begins. Mongoose, more than anything else, was a covert operation that was Pentagon-based, right? This was the Joint Chiefs were behind this. Like, CIA would have been involved, but a lot of this was focused on using military assets. When the Bay of Pigs fails, the CIA is kind of licking its wounds. But when there's a non-intervention pledge after the Cuban Missile Crisis, CIA is back in the game, right? They kind of put me in coach. And so we're not doing anything overtly. We're not going to send another fighting force of Cuban exiles into Cuba, but the CIA now can do its magic and start working in a very covert way of running guns and supplies and other things into Cuba, creating an asset network on the island that we assumed was passing us good information. It wasn't, but we thought it was.
We'll get to that too.
Yeah. We thought it was, you know, I have family members and friends of family members who worked at JM Wave, the CIA station there, who were constantly in radio communication with who people we thought were our guys down in Cuba, but also establishing weapons drops and caches of money and all sorts of things to, you know, kind of do what the dream was, to create a Paris in 1944 environment inside of Cuba, where you have this resistance movement that's blowing up bridges and harassing the Cuban government. It never comes to fruition, mainly because the Cubans are able to consolidate their power so viciously that these movements just don't happen the way they would otherwise. But that was the dream at the time.
And to the point that, you know, you talk about, you know, at one point, the CIA is like the largest employer in Miami.
In the state of Florida, not just in Miami.
Yeah.
Right?
Say a word or two about the front companies that open in Miami. That's a really kind of illustrative part of this period.
Yeah. So JM Wave was the code name for the Miami station, but it was never called that publicly. Zenith.
And that's using like an acronym designator that the CIA uses. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's two letters at the front, which is a geographical designator. And then some random code word after that. So JM
is, yeah.
Well, JM's not Miami, but JM was actually somewhere in the Philippines, but they used it to kind of mess with everybody, you know. But the idea essentially was that Wave was a randomly generated word, and then you had the JM moniker at the beginning of it. But it didn't go by that publicly. It went by Zenith Technical Industries or Zenith Technical Enterprises publicly.
Of course.
Yeah, it was the most mundane name that you would never think as it's something you'd pass in a kind of industrial park and never give it a second look.
Acme Manufacturing Concern.
Right, exactly. The funny part about that is the only people who didn't know that the CIA station was common knowledge in Miami were people that worked at the CIA station. Nah. Everyone in Miami knew that that was the CIA. My father told a wonderful story. His roommate from college, who I won't name, his roommate from college worked for CIA after he graduated. And one day his car broke down. He needed a ride to work. So he asked my dad, he's like, "Hey, can you give me a ride to work?" And my dad didn't know what he did for a living, but said, "Oh yeah, sure. Just show me where." And so they drive south on US 1 down by where the zoo is today in Miami. And his friend is kind of directing him, turn right here, turn left here. And they finally turn left into Zenith Technical Industries. And my dad pulls up to the gate and turns to his friend and goes, "I didn't know you worked for the CIA." And because everyone knew. And so his friend was like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? It's like, look, everyone knows this. And it got to the point where a local Miami newspaper just outed them and said, "Yep, you know, this is the CIA." And so they didn't close up shop. They didn't say, "Whoa, we better get out of here." No, they just changed their name to Melmar Incorporated. And they had like 15 other names during this time period. We list them all in the book. And it's not just the JM Wave had names, but also their little offshoots, like the Navy Force and other things like that, had their own little really ridiculous names that you would never look at twice. And that was the intent, right? The intent was to bore you into not paying attention. Nowadays, we look at them and kind of laugh because it really is kind of like Acme Industries, and it's like something that Dr. Evil would come up with.
Right.
But at the time, the idea was, let's just make it so, you know, not memorable that no one will give it a second look.
Yeah. There's a lot of colorful characters in the book, as one might imagine, and really some fabulous people. One of them is a guy that appears early on, is a guy named Orlando Bosch. Tell us a little bit about him.
So Orlando Bosch and his crime buddy, for lack of a better term, Luis Posada Carillas, are two guys who started out like many other Cuban exiles of just kind of the dream of taking back Cuba from Castro. At some point, 99% of the exiles moved off in one direction, and Bosch and others move off in another. And they decided that the U.S. government was not doing enough, the exile community was not doing enough to get Castro out of power. And so they said, "Oh, the gloves are off." And the two of them are really the ones that Eric pushed back against us, terming terrorists. But it's really hard not to. These are guys who are responsible for attacks on the United Nations in New York while a Cuban delegate was there, while Che was there. And by attacks, I mean launching a missile from across the bay. Fortunately, they're really bad at it. And so they didn't actually kill anybody or hit the United Nations, but they tried to for a series of bombs that happened throughout South Florida in the 1960s and 70s. Probably, I mean, there's no one else who possibly could have done this, although the proof is circumstantial, for blowing up a Cubana airline, a civilian airliner, and killing everyone on board. You know, when Al-Qaeda does that, we use the word terrorism without really worrying about it. When Bosch and others do it, they call them freedom fighters. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was a movement in Florida, in Miami, to create Orlando Bosch Day. And this is in the 1990s. So this is two decades after he blew up an airliner. And so fortunately it failed, right? So this is one of the things we can look at and go, okay, well, there are still some rational, reasonable people there. But those two especially were always kind of half embraced by the Cuban community because they were doing things, and half shunned because really the key after the covert action ends, the key after it becomes clear that there's not going to be a reinvasion anytime soon, the Cuban community realized the key of staying relevant was political power, was staying kind of on the good side of the U.S. government. And Bosch and others were making them look really bad. And that was something where they nudge, nudge, wink, wink, like, "Hey, we love what you're doing. Just stop making us look bad and doing it." And so there's a really interesting dichotomy there between those that overtly come out in the public and say, oh no, this, we completely disown these guys, while at the same time are bailing them out of jail, are providing them with funding. I'm not going to get sued by naming names. We kind of do in the book. It's almost open understanding. Because some of these people have a lot of money and they're still around in Miami. But the idea is that there's a lot of talking out of both sides of the mouth of trying to maintain a public image of being upstanding members of the now American community. Most of these people become American citizens at this point, and they're vying for political power, which we now know is massive, right? You know, in South Florida, but at the same time are trying to do something or anything against the Castro government. And so in the 70s, especially, there's a series of bombings in Miami,
yeah,
right? So they're not just attacking Cuban airliners. They're attacking businesses down in Miami who are doing, have relationships with Cubans. Most of them, you know, obviously not Miami, like Mexican consulates and like companies that are working in Miami. A Polish freighter, a cargo ship, where if you drive around where the cruise ships are in Miami right now, there's a Polish cargo ship that was attacked also with a missile while it was sitting in port, you know, because the Poles were part of the Soviet bloc and that those are commies and those were bad guys. And so it's an interesting time to be down there. I didn't exist yet, but for those that I've talked to there in the 70s, it was the Wild West.
Yeah,
because you would have, on one hand, people during the day who were working with members of Congress and trying to get bills passed, and then the evening they would go out to the Everglades to work with, you know, Omega 7 or Alpha 66, which are these paramilitary organizations that were training on assassinations of other things. It was an interesting time. And then all the drugs showed up in the 80s. So it got really interesting.
Right. For listeners who are listening to this thinking like, my God, this sounds like a foreign capital. I mean, we should emphasize this is both kind of in a period prior to, you know, in a time when intelligence operations maybe were a little bit more off the chain. It's before the scandals of Iran-Contra, which we'll get to in a little bit. But also this is before, you know, the successive generations of the Cuban exile community are becoming politically active and getting elected to Congress. This is before Ileana Ros Latham. This is well before Marco Rubio. So we think of Miami in Florida now today as such a kind of political bastion with connections to the Cuban exile community, but this hadn't happened yet. So this is much more of a rambunctious kind of period, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Miami today is jointly called the capital of Latin America. But also the joke people make is what makes Miami so great is how close it is to the United States. because it's kind of its own little entity, its bubble there. And, you know, and this is a time when this generation, and you're exactly right, is starting to gain political power because they're starting to gain financial power. They're starting to understand how the American system works and how you can, you know, not buy your way into power, but at least have a seat at the table when you're talking about policy because of money and because of politics. And you know, the generation that includes Marco Rubio's parents and Ileana Ros Latham's parents and the Diaz Balart's family are the ones that come from this first group in the 1960s and 70s. And so their kids are the ones raised in this environment. And they now are embracing kind of the American dream and the power that comes from South Florida. But you're right. This is a Wild West. I mean, this is and the fun part about it is even with this, and we'll talk about this as we go along, if you want to, the fun part about this Wild West aspect of Miami is it doesn't go away. Right, it kind of goes underground a little bit, but it's still there today. It never really leaves, you know. And that's one of the arguments that we make is what's great about Miami is that when the Cold War ends in 1989 or 91 or whatever date you want to use the end of the Cold War, it ends everywhere but one place, Miami, right? Where we're still fighting it there today.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's not like it's not just Cuba. It's kind of this. It's what we have this idea of Castroism or Fidelism, of this ideology that is spread throughout Latin America and places in Africa that is still, you know, being fought by not only the American government, but the people down in Miami are fighting it tooth and nail every single day.
Yeah, and you can look at a politician like a Marco Rubio who is so vocal about you know, being against Putin and in support of Ukraine and about warning about China. And I mean, you can see how those influences that he would have grown up with from parents and grandparents who were reacting to socialism and communism and, you know, Fidelism in Cuba and its connections with Soviet imperialism, as you know, as they saw it, are still present in him. It's informing the foreign policy, you know, thinking of a leading Republican who ran for president at one point.
Yeah, and I think that we're all somewhat surprised, but we shouldn't have been, when in 2016 and then later in 2020, when the Cuban exile community backed Donald Trump, because he's, you know, as a human, he's not necessarily who they tend to look toward as someone to emulate. But President Obama went down and opened up Cuba.
Right.
And that was the mortal sin, right? You just cannot do that while the Castro boys are still in power or any kind of Fidelism is still there. And, you know, and the generation that Eric is a part of, right? So the second, third generation in Miami, the Gen X and beyond, are much more open to the idea of a relationship with Cuba. Mm. But the boomers, those that came over after 59, are still alive. They vote in numbers that are like 98% of them vote, right? Whereas it's like 12% of young people, right? So they have unbelievable political power there that's not going to go away until they start dying. And then in many cases, they've taught their kids well, the Marco Rubios of the world and others who are going to carry this torch. And so that's not going to change very, very quickly. I mean, you're already seeing it change in the way it's going in the red direction, right? You know, the midterm elections where Miami-Dade County actually goes red for the first time in a long time.
Yeah,
it's because of this view of Castroism still spreading throughout the Latin American region, the Caribbean region, and even places as far away as sub-Saharan Africa in Eastern Asia.
Yeah. You alluded earlier in the conversation to the Mariel Boatlift, and you can remind kind of folks what that was about. But I also want to talk about there's a scene in your book where Jimmy Carter is at kind of like a town hall event, essentially, right? And he's asked a question about issues around, you know, Cuban immigration or migration to the United States. And you write about this as a moment where the things that he said are heard as words of support to Miamians to start bringing as many people as they can from Cuba to the U.S. So talk about this period when this weaponization of waves of people starts.
Yes. I mean, if you know what we know about Jimmy Carter, even if you have very little knowledge about the Carter administration, he was focused on human rights almost to a fault, where it kind of got in the way of kind of the realpolitik of the administrations prior to him and certainly the administration after him under Reagan. And his idea was that immigration, if you wanted to leave somewhere, you should have the right to leave somewhere. And this is true about Cuba, the Soviet Union, anywhere else. And so it was very easy for him to look 90 miles south of Florida and find a regime that was not letting people leave when they wanted to. And so a lot of it was a response to the Nixon and Ford administrations, which had somewhat curtailed the amount of immigrants that could come over from Cuba. Carter was like, you know, when people are looking for freedom, we should welcome them with open arms, you know, kind of standing in front of the Statue of Liberty type of thing, like, come on in. And Castro looked at this and number one was annoyed that he was being lectured. He was always, you know, Castro was a narcissist. He was always somebody who, how dare you lecture me about this, but also saw this as a massive opportunity. Castro very brilliantly used immigration as a way to deal with domestic issues. When there was a lot of people rising up and he had problems, if people were protesting, which he didn't do a lot of in Cuba, but at least if you're speaking out against the Cuban government, but also if you're walking into issues dealing with Cuban economy slowing down, you know, this is the time, the 70s, where the Soviet Union's going through stagflation. They're not really able to support the Cubans as much. The Cuban government is going through an issue of economic downturn. In a communist socialist system, that's problematic. And the way to relieve that problem is get rid of some people. And the way to relieve your domestic political problems is get rid of the people that don't like you very much. It's kind of the way to relieve tension. It's kind of like, you know, the pressure is building up and you can relieve that pressure by saying, all right, go. And so Mariel was a brilliant, genius response by Castro, where he said, all right, at this point, anyone and everyone who wants to leave can leave. If you want to come pick them up, come pick them up. Go ahead. You got a couple days to pull this off. At the end of that, I'm stopping it. But for this time period, anyone who wants to leave can leave as long as they get a ride, right? So this massive armada of boats leaves from Miami, zooms down there and just fills them up from, you know, hull to stern of people bringing them back to the United States. We're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of them. Now, what makes this a wonderful coup for the Castro regime is that he says, you want to keep talking about political prisoners, Jimmy Carter? Fine. We're going to release a bunch of them. They all can leave if they want to also. You know, this included people in insane asylums because, and that's the problem with this is that there's nuance to it, right? A lot of the critics of Marielle said he opened the prison doors and the insane asylums. So all those, the crazy people and the criminals all came to Miami. No, the nuance there is the people who were in prison were not there because they robbed banks or were rapists. The people in prison are there because they spoke out against the Castro regime. The people in the insane asylums were not there because they were schizophrenic or they had multiple personalities. They're there because it was crazy to speak out against the Castro regime, right? They just basically institutionalized you if you were someone who spoke out against the regime. So these were not people who were riffraff. So the Mariel boat lift, still to this day, and you can actually see this, the series Griselda, which talks about Griselda Blanco and kind of her rise to power in Miami, has the Marielitos, as they were called, as her like gunmen. And yes, some of them did come over and work for the cartels and shoot up malls in Dade County. That was like 1% of 1%. But that's what all of them were painted with because of Castro's information operations were so effective at this point that it became, to this day, an understanding that the Mariel boat lift brought a bunch of riffraff over.
Right.
And you even hear this from the Cuban community where people are like, well, you know, we came before 1980. You know, almost as like a coded message for we're not the Marielito, we're not the riffraff, we're the people who came here to work, which is absolutely false. But Castro did such a good job of making everyone think that way that still to this day, Americans in pop culture and even the Cuban community in Little Havana makes that argument.
Yeah, it's fascinating the way that those kind of stigmas and those caste systems persist. I mean, it is, you get so much of this through the book of this idea, this picture of Miami as a city that is very much in touch with its own history and these generations. And they're all kind of still living through it. And that was such a fascinating time. I didn't really appreciate the degree to which Jimmy Carter kind of played an instigating force because of his human rights concerns. It's something that kind of, it transcends the typical politics that we think of as defining the Cold War, but it does very much go to the idea, I think, that a lot of American officials had, that this was, the Cold War was ultimately about a battle of human dignity and liberation.
Well, that starts, I mean, you don't see that certainly under the Nixon regime. Like Kennedy Kissinger's not making that argument, right? No. It's all about power at that point. But you do get that under the Carter administration. That continues under the Reagan administration also.
Yeah.
I mean, Reagan
and power too, but yeah, but yes.
Yeah, well, I was saying Reagan didn't, I'm not sure if Reagan necessarily thought that way, but they understood kind of the usefulness of talking about human rights.
Right,
of
portraying it through that lens, yes.
Yeah, about the ideological, even if ideology wasn't the foundation of their foreign policy, they saw it as a useful tool.
Yeah.
Whereas Nixon and other, you know, I mean, until Carter, you don't get that.
Yeah. Well, this kind of gets us neatly to another chapter in the book of the period of Miami and the role that it played in the Iran-Contra affair. Certainly not a place where I would say the battle for human rights and human dignity was paramount. It was certainly not. We don't have time to go into all of the Iran-Contra affair. You might give a quick synopsis if you want for people, because it is such a thicket of just conspiracies and weirdness. But talk a bit about the role that Miami plays in that scandal. This is in the second term of the Reagan administration. And talk a little bit about another one of these colorful characters in your book, Felix Rodriguez, and how he comes in.
Yeah, so Iran-Contra is planned in Miami. We were not surprised to learn that. well, and in many cases, Miami had been the hub in the 60s, 70s, and 80s of operations in Central and South America that were either funded by or supported by CIA. During the time of the Contra, the support to the Contras, we had already been supporting the forces in El Salvador And that was a big deal during the Reagan administration because the anti-communist forces in El Salvador were, you know, commonly referred to as death squads, right? Mm-hmm. They were accused of murdering nuns. They were not necessarily people that the American public wanted to support, but the Reagan administration, the CIA, was covertly supporting them, including a man named Felix Rodriguez, who is an incredibly interesting character. He goes back to pre-Bay of Pigs. He pops up throughout the book in multiple places. He's somebody who's still alive. I know him well. He is absolutely a fascinating man. The Cuban government is still trying to kill him to this day because he pissed them off so much by capturing Che Guevara and a lot of other things. But Felix actually had been working in El Salvador running supplies and other things to the anti-communist forces there when Oliver North and his cronies set up shop in Miami to plan Iran-Contra and realized that there was already kind of a system designed earlier by CIA and by Felix that could help them ship these arms into Nicaragua, which is where the Contras were fighting the Sandinistas. Now, the scandal, of course, comes not to – we can get it, talk 5 hours about this. The scandal comes because Congress had explicitly said you can't do this. And the Reagan administration, well, who probably Ronald Reagan, George Bush kind of falls on his sword as vice president and people below fall on their sword. But likely the highest levels of the Reagan administration approve going around Congress and doing this surreptitiously.
Because they're doing it through the White House and their logic is this isn't the intelligence community. It's the White House doing it.
Exactly. It's the National Security Council. So Oliver North is a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps working for the National Security Council. For whatever reason, they decide to give a light bird Marine all this power to run American foreign policy in Central America. Oliver North now, you know, later on becomes a darling of the kind of conspiracy theory right wing radio and TV. That's how he was at the time also.
Oh, he yeah. He's like proto QAnon. In the White House.
Yes. Yeah. Like in a very high position in the National Security Council. You know, he's basically Mike Flynn before Mike Flynn.
Correct.
I think that's a great way. But Mike Flynn was a 3-star general and Oliver North was a lieutenant colonel.
Right.
So there's a little bit of a difference there. But North is basically running his own private army. And Felix is ready to go along with this in the beginning. Because Felix, like many others, is 100% anything we can do to fight commies is good for me because then we're fighting against Castroism and we're fighting, you know, communism anywhere is fighting Castro. But then realizes very quickly that what Iran-Contra was doing was not necessarily giving a lot of supplies to the Contras. Part of the scandal that people don't realize is that the vast majority of the money was going into the pockets of the private contractors and gun runners that they had hired to do this. And so people were getting very rich off the backs of these Contras. And, you know, like the Contras, hate the Contras, for the Cuban community in Miami, they're freedom fighters. They're fighting communism in Nicaragua the same way they wish they could be fighting communism in Cuba. And so the Contra movement becomes like the cause celeb in South Florida in the 1980s. And so Felix is 100% behind helping the Contras. But then he realizes that the money is not going to help the Contras. And his pilots that are ferrying guns in there are like, our planes are falling apart in the air as we're flying them. Like, they don't work. The weapons don't work. They're giving us crap and they're pocketing all the money. And so Felix flies back to Miami and starts yelling at everybody, threatens everybody as he should. And then they decide to shut down the program as some kind of press gets involved. And Felix is afraid they're going to sell off all the aircraft for money, right? And so Felix steals a plane from Miami and flies it back down to Nicaragua saying, you're not going to get this plane. And, you know, it's just a wonderful scene to me where he's just like, you know what? I'm just going to steal the plane.
Yeah.
And there's great Oliver North just losing his mind in documents, writing back to people he shouldn't write back to, like, you know, John Poindexter and people at the highest levels going, that Rodriguez asshole just stole our plane. And I'm just laughing the whole, because it's just, it really shows the difference, and it's hard not to be cynical about the people who were doing this because it shows how truly dedicated they were to this. Felix didn't give a shit about American foreign policy, if it wasn't helping the people that he felt needed to be helped.
Yeah.
And he's like, I have no problem screwing you guys over, even though you literally are like the national security advisor. I'm going to take this because you're not doing what you need to do to help the people who are fighting against Castro.
Yeah. I wrote a book years ago that was in large part about John Poindexter, mostly his life after 9/11, but it got into Iran-Contra. And one of the things that impressed me about that period, and there's been lots written about Iran-Contra, but that you capture in the book, is how utterly off the rails that covert operation became. Yeah. And there's something perfect about the quality and the character of that bonkers White House operation contrasted with just the tumult and the craziness of Miami in the 1980s. And it's like, well, of course they go marriage. Together.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I will say too, by the way, I like this. Maybe you want to say a word that you titled the chapter on Iran-Contra, up, up, down, down, left, right, BA start, which is a pretty deep cut. If you played Nintendo in the 1980s and 90s, you will know that that was the secret tap tap you did on the hand controller in the video game Contra, which like got you like unlimited life or something like that.
It's a Konami code that gave you 30 lives.
For yeah, yeah. So that's your Gen X, you know, your roots showing. I like that. Yeah, that was a nice code that you threw in there.
Eric and I are the same age, and we kind of threw that out as a, you know what, you get out of your wall.
I was going to say, I was reading the chapter being like, are they going to come back to this? I'm like, no, it's just if you know, you know. Yeah. Maybe you had to fight your editor on that one. I'm not sure.
You know what? They surprisingly, after the last book that I wrote, Nuking the Moon, people knew what they were getting into when they decided to work with me. And so I think they understood we were going to have our tongue firmly planted in our cheek when we had the opportunity to.
It's a nice thing, by the way, I should note for people this goes back to your point about you writing a 900 page academic tome. It's concise. You're going to move very quickly. The footnotes are kind of delightful in this book. People should know, because there are moments where Vince and Eric kind of peek out from behind the curtain and sort of like, and sometimes in tongue in cheek ways, like talk to the audience. So they're really fun, I should say. They're kind of not the end notes, but little footnotes on the page or little asides that you guys make to the audience are fun.
Yeah, thank you. We had to fight with the copy editor about that. And it's Well, one of the interesting things about this is sourcing also, and this is a good segue, is when you're done with a book, a little inside baseball, as some of your listeners may have written before, the copy editing process is a sludge. It is just people going through every word and every footnote. And some of the documents that we used, especially when we talk about the exile communities down in Miami, are not from the National Archives. They literally live in a Tupperware bin in Eric Driggs's living room because they were his grandfather's. And so he's got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of documents about the exile Navy and about all these things that happened right in the very beginning of the move to Miami. And so we had arguments, and I've got the emails, for several day-long arguments with a copy editor about how do we reference this in the footnotes. And he just couldn't grasp. He's like, where is this archive? And finally, I'm like, it's in Eric's living room. They're like, well, we can't say that. I'm like, well, let's just call it the Driggs Family Archive. And that was finally what we decided on. But just this idea of such an insider look is really what Eric helps bring to the table here, is his family lived this stuff. Yeah. You know, and I'm looking at it from like government, like I spent the time in the archives and dealing with CIA docs and stuff. And he's like my grandfather. And it's just a really wonderful team up that we're able to bring to bear on this book.
Yeah. Yeah. And to that point of, you know, the family and the connection to, there's a line that struck me in the book that I feel like really kind of gets to the heart of the whole tension in the book between, you know, U.S. policy towards Cuba and how Cubans in Miami, you know, saw their lives and the island. And the line was, being aligned and wanting Castro gone was helpful, but not sufficient. Washington wasn't as dedicated to regime change as they were to containment. Containment, however, doesn't get you back home. Talk a little bit just to, in present terms, how, I mean, Castro is dead. I mean, he was a master of longevity in addition to, yes, you know, propaganda. You know, is the desire to see the regime in Cuba overthrown and Cuba go back to what it was before Castro something that is still as vibrant in the Miami of today?
Yeah, so I don't know if anyone wants to see it go back to what it was before Castro. I think that's interesting. Eric's family, as an aside, very quick aside, Eric's family is one of the only families to actually leave Cuba twice. Because they leave Cuba during the Bautista regime because it was absolutely repressive. And it was a dictatorship that was terrible. And they go back after Castro comes to power. Because they actually welcome the Castro revolution. They're like, oh, this guy might be able to fix the problems that we've had. But then Castro goes very far to the left, embraces the Soviets, so they leave again. I don't think anyone wants to see it go back to Bautista. I think what they want to do is to bring democracy to Cuba. And I think that's true. I mean, still to this day, is people still have this dream. Now, I had always heard growing up in the 80s and the 90s that when Castro dies, everyone's going to go back and reclaim their land. And that was going to be the big, you know, migration back to Havana. This was a kind of a reality almost over and over again. We have actually a chapter we call Schrodinger's Castro, where there are multiple times in our lifetime, starting in the 90s, certainly, where there were reports that Castro was dead, and like major reports that Castro was dead. And so everyone in La Havana would go out on the street with their wooden spoons in their pots and bang them together and have, you know, play music and dance. And then the next day he'd give a speech in public live and like, gosh, she's still alive. And this happened over and over and over again. And finally in 2016, he dies of really, really old age. But at that point, he hadn't really been in charge for a long time. His brother had been running the country. And even if his brother hadn't taken over for him, the Castroism, as we've talked about before, was ever prevalent in Cuba, and it had spread throughout the Latin American region. And so none of this had really mattered all that much when Castro died. It didn't change anything. There was a great party in Miami because the Cubans there really, really dislike Castro for obvious reasons. But I don't know that anything really changed all that much. And so a lot of people today would love for, you know, Western liberal reform to take place in Cuba. Just no one's holding their breath. I mean, I think that, you know, even though you have an entirely new generation of leadership there, I mean, the current Cuban president is basically kind of on the boomer Gen X borderline, right? He's young, but his ideas are exactly the same. And American policy is exactly the same. And even as much as the Obama administration tried to thaw things a little bit, they were baby steps. And, you know, that's not something that's going to make a massive difference. This is not, you know, like, you know, Moscow in the 80s, where you're just flooding it with McDonald's and, you know, heavy metal music and trying to make it, you know, open up with glasnost. There's no glasnost and perestroika going on inside Cuba. So I don't know if the generations are going to begin to die off before any change happens in Cuba, you know, where you're going to have people like Eric, who were born in the United States, who are more centrist than right wing. I'm not saying they're not all left leaning, that's for sure. But they're certainly more rational when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. You know, maybe you'll start seeing changes. I'm actually interested in a completely separate note to see now that Miami-Dade County went red in the last election, if it goes red again in 2024, if the Democrats stop giving a shit about winning South Florida and start pushing hard for a change in Cuban policy. What's always been interesting in Miami politics is even when you had Democrats as members of Congress, like Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who has been there for a long time, she's basically Miami Beach and Weston. When you had people like Joe Garcia, who was a Cuban-American, who was a member of Congress there for the Democrats, they were in lockstep with people like Ileana and the Diaz-Balarts and others on Cuba policy, because you had to be.
Yeah.
Right. You are not going to get elected down there to Congress if you are not in lockstep, and you are going to basically give up Florida in any kind of national election. Well, if Florida is more red than purple, and if South Florida is so red that you're not going to win any kind of congressional district unless you're in a heavily, like Debbie Wasserman Schultz is in a heavily Jewish population in Broward, then why back these harsh policies toward Cuba? Because you're not worried about winning over that vote. And so I have no idea if it's going to change anything, but I'm interested to see if people just kind of have a rational change in thought about, you know what, who cares about the Cuban vote because they're gone, right? Yeah. They are Republican or they're already Democrat, right? Because the younger voters tend to be more Democrat. And then Miami is changing in such an interesting way also, because it's not even the Hispanic community in Miami is not even majority Cuban anymore. It's still massive. It's like 49% Cuban, but it's 51% from other Latin American nations. Now, they don't make up any one block, right? So the Cuban block is still predominant, but they're starting, you're starting to see more of a Hispanic melting pot down in Miami that's changing politics pretty dramatically. And then you have people from other places in the world, like Russia, coming over into Sunny Isles and to Trump properties. The true anchor baby problem there is they're coming to have kids who have American passports when they're brought back to the Russian, you know, back to Russia, and they're all oligarchs' kids. So there's already some conversation within the intelligence community about this could be a real problem 20 years down the road when you have a Russian oligarch kid with a U.S. passport.
Yes. Yeah, and protections of the U.S. legal system.
Yep.
You spend a lot of time in the book writing, obviously, about the you know what's going on in Miami and what the CIA is trying to do to influence events in Cuba. But one of the really impressive parts of the story, and you spend a little bit of time on this, is that how good the Cuban intelligence service is. And it's really worth kind of just as a stressing for readers, you're not making the argument that Cuba is like good for a small country. You're putting it on par with, you know, other major intelligence services. And there's a vivid example of this that I want you to tell, and then you can elaborate. But you write that in June of 1987, there was a Cuban intelligence officer named Florentino Aspiaga Lombard who defects to the United States. And he tells the Americans something, and you alluded to this earlier, that is just utterly shocking about the people that the CIA has recruited in Cuba. What is that?
Had to be so embarrassing. So he basically said that since 1964, so since the CIA really started running operations inside Cuba, till 1987, not a single person the CIA thought they had recruited to spy for the United States was actually working for the CIA. Every single one of them had been doubled back against us. Let me repeat that. Every single asset we thought we had in Cuba for over 20 years was actually working for Castro the whole time, kicking us bad information, purposeful disinformation, was breaking up any attempts we had of building any kind of coherent opposition on the island. This was, like you said, not just good for a dinky little island country. This is good for anyone.
Yes.
And you could argue that, you know, they used to talk about like people like Roy Jones Jr., the boxers, pound for pound, the best fighter ever. The Cubans were pound for pound, the best intelligence agency that's ever stepped on the planet. They were really, really good with the limited resources they had. But forget the pound for pound stuff. They should be considered in the upper top 10 of intelligence agencies, regardless of size, certainly during this time period. Because not only did they turn everybody we sent their way, so their counterintelligence was unbelievably impressive, but their human intelligence was also unbelievably impressive. There's no way to prove this one way or the other, but people like, you know, people in the University of Miami Cuba Center, people within the FBI have estimated that one out of every 10 Cuban exiles actually worked for the Cuban intelligence service, was actually a plant of the DGI. And we can't prove that again, but now we know from Cubans who have been arrested for spying by FBI and others, whether it was the WAS network, which was operating in the United States, mainly in the Tampa area around Special Operations Command and in the Miami area around Southcom, and working against organizations like Brothers of the Rescue, that was rolled up by the FBI. People like Ana Montes, who talk about a brilliant Cuban intelligence operation. She was at the. She was a true mole.
Yeah.
She was recruited when she was still in grad school, and they told her find a job in the U.S. government that has security clearance, and she did, and she worked her way up to the highest levels of DIA.
We did an episode on her. Yeah, folks remember that.
You know, Pete Lapp, who wrote, who actually was the one who arrested her, writes a great book about this. She was the DIA expert on Cuba, and they thought she had, you know, basically almost like precognition because she would anticipate what Cuba was doing when it was the Cuban government was feeding her what they were about to do, so she could actually look like she was a great analyst. That's as good as it gets. And they did this with no money whatsoever and with no resources. And the real scary part about Cuba and about the kind of the Cuban system is they're exceptionally good at trading things for resources that they need. Now, part of it is, you know, you always, everyone's like, oh, the Cuban medical schools are free and the Cuban doctors are the best in the world. None of them are in Cuba, right? They're all in Venezuela and in Russia because they trade their doctors for oil and for resources. Well, the Cubans at a very early time period realized that information was a valuable resource. And so they don't just spy on the United States and the Cuban community in the United States. They pick up every piece of information they possibly can, because even if it doesn't apply to them, they can sell it other places. They can trade it. So they've sold to Hamas. They sold to the Soviets, the Chinese, all of our adversaries around the world. The worry was with Ana Montes, the reason she was arrested is that we were worried she was going to sell information to the Cubans who would give it to Al-Qaeda or to the Taliban, right? They didn't care. If it got them back what they needed, they did that. And so this was an organization that not only was good at turning our people, but was so good at putting people into place in the United States that had access to valuable information that they have to be considered top 10 all time when it comes to intelligence agencies. Now, is the CIA better? Yes. But is the CIA's budget 500 times what the DGI's budget is? Yes. Right? Do they have 5,000 times as many people? Yes. And that's really where you have to give credit where credit's due when it comes to the Cuban intelligence service.
Yeah, and the information about the doubles attributed to Lombard, I've heard that from people who worked on Cuba in the agency, who may have well heard it from him, but I think they believed him. So it really is something that I think is just – it's such a shocking example of both the failure of our side but the extreme talent of their counterintelligence capability.
Well, and I think when you talk about believing him, so yeah, this could be a dangle itself, right? But the idea is they did a post-mortem, and both the FBI and the CIA went back and said, oh, that's why none of this was working.
I think they believe it. And the bit of time we have left, let's talk about Elian Gonzalez.
Yeah.
I think, you know, listeners are probably sufficiently of age that we don't need to remind them, but just quickly, young Cuban boy, he's brought over with his parents, like on a raft, or his mother and his stepfather. They die in the transit. He makes it to Florida. He is taken in by relatives here, and his father in Cuba wants him back, and he becomes this just unbelievable media sensation, national media sensation, which of course culminates with armed guards going into the house, forcibly taking him. There's this picture of this terrified boy and a man in a mask grabbing him. Talk a little bit about the legacy of Elian Gonzalez and the symbol that really played in this huge chapter of, you know, not just Miami and Cuba, but the U.S.
Right.
and Cuba.
So I wrote this chapter and my original draft is dramatically different than what ends up in the book. Because my original draft is like, this moron community, like this kid, he's Jesus. And I was very snarky about Elian Gonzalez because me, like 98% of the rest of the country, thought this was the dumbest thing we'd ever seen.
Yeah, it had that quality of just media circus. And for God's sake, just figure out this... Like, figure out the custody crap. Just figure
right.
it out.
I mean, if it was anywhere but Cuba, this is a straightforward custody battle, right? The dad has the right, you send him back. But the Cuban community was like, no, we're not going to send him back, right? His mom died bringing him to freedom. Like, we're going to respect it. The problem was his family was not the Waltons, right? His family was convicted felons and people who had been arrested for drugs and weapons and all these other things. And then his neighbors basically were a part of like Alpha 66, right? They were the kind of far extreme of the Cuban exile community. And so for the rest of the country, including me, I mean, I wasn't even in Miami at that point. I was still in the Army. So I was watching this from Texas at what used to be Fort Hood. And everyone around me is looking at me like, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with your hometown? They didn't understand how crazy things were going. And so the original chapter was written kind of that perspective. And Eric looked at it and said, this is all wrong. And I'm like, what do you mean it's all wrong? It's like, you are writing this from a outsider perspective, and we're not outsiders. Like, you need to understand what Elian meant as a symbol. And as a symbol, he meant everything the Cubans had been fighting for four decades at this point, of this idea of a chance at freedom. And the argument was that Elian Gonzalez, if he had been sent back to his father, that he would be used as another propaganda tool by the Castro regime, as another information operation. And what turns out to be the case is that's true, right? So Elian Gonzalez is now a member of the Cuban parliament. He is somebody who has had kind of the silver spoon in his mouth ever since he went back. As Eric adds into the chapter, he was the one 10-year-old that had Fidel Castro show up to his birthday party after he was sent back, right? So this is more nuanced than we all kind of looked at it. But the long-lasting legacy is 537 votes. And there's an outstanding documentary by a documentarian named Billy Corbin, who's done a lot of really interesting documentaries about Miami, one of them being Cocaine Cowboys. He did a documentary called 537 Votes, which is about the 537 votes that separated Al Gore from George Bush in Florida in the 2000 election. And why that matters is because over 10,000 more Cubans voted for Bill Clinton in 1996 than voted for Al Gore in 2000. So it wasn't like a handful more. It was thousands and thousands and thousands more. And so Gore, if he only held on to some of those, then he wins the election straight out. There's no crazy Bush versus Gore in the 2000 election. And what craters the Cuban community's support for Bill Clinton is Elian Gonzalez. And the Janet Reno-led Justice Department that sent in the guys with MP5s and helmets to grab the guy in the closet. And what's really interesting about that also is everyone's like, what a stupid thing for Janet Reno to do. Why are you sending these guys in full battle rattle and everything? But like I said, the house next door actually had armed men who were part of the Cuban exile community who were technically terrorists. Some of the family members were wanted or had convictions for firearms and other weapons charges. So it wasn't, you're not going to send someone in with nothing on. So this story was really fascinating to me in talking with Eric about it, because we're coming at it from opposite sides. And eventually we started far apart, but eventually we worked our way into creating a story of Elian Gonzalez that is guaranteed to piss everyone off. Like, we could have gone one way, like my way, which is piss the Cubans off. We could have gone Eric's way, which would have made everyone kind of laugh at us. But we went so nuanced and so objective that no one's going to be happy with us. Which, I mean, I think you're done good history at that point, because then you are truly writing reality, which in this case is just not something that makes anyone happy.
Yeah. And I think he's kind of, you know, his story kind of coming at the end of the book is a nice way of summing this up, because I think that one of the reasons that he became such a powerful symbol, right, is he is a child, and into him, these two warring camps, if we want to think of them that way, are pouring all of their ambition and desire for the future, all of their trauma from the past, and they're fighting over him, because whoever gets to claim him gets this win of like the stake in the future. And as you pointed out, I mean, he is, it's hard to see him now as anything but a mouthpiece for Castroism. I mean, it's kind of like absurd. I mean, talking about, like, didn't he have a quote of something? I don't believe in God, but if I did, the closest thing would be Fidel.
Yeah. And it's a lot of people down there are like, see, I told you so.
And we can't know for sure if he's just saying it. I'm not saying he's been brainwashed, but, you know, Cuba has held him up as a victory, and he is a human symbol and has been for two decades now.
Well, he did not have an average upbringing, right? Most Cuban 10-year-olds are not having parties with Fidel.
Nor would he have had an average upbringing in Miami. I mean, you could probably imagine someone trying to get him to run for local office or for Congress when he came, when he turned 25.
Some of my favorite scenes from that are like, people were starting to see like the face of Ilion, like they saw the face of Jesus and bread.
Right.
And like, you know, there's a billboard in Miami that was basically Moses, Jesus, and Ilion. And yeah, so he would not have a normal life if he had stayed in Miami, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, he is very much a symbol of what at the heart of this book is really all about, human emotion and passion and dreams, really. I mean, the dreams that people have and how they fight for them. The last question, as you know, on Chatter is always we reach in here to the Chatter box and ask a question. I don't think there's anything Cuba related in this box, but there might be some questions that are on point for you and possibly as an intelligence historian. All right, let's see what this one says. This is very good. This is excellent for you, Vince.
All right.
Who played the best Bond?
Ooh, so best Bond and subjective. Now, if it's Bond most like Ian Fleming's book, you have to kind of go with George Lazenby is the most Bond. So he only plays it once.
Controversial choice. Okay. Explain.
So, well, I mean, the Bond in the books is this womanizing brute, who basically like kind of just, very much the way Daniel Craig plays James Bond is kind of the fists of fury kind of
the
thing.
Blunt instrument. Yeah.
Right. But so Lazenby was the combination of the blunt instrument plus the swarminess of the Sean Connery Bond, or the Roger Moore 70s pimp suit walking through Harlem Bond.
Yeah.
So the Daniel Craig one, he respects women, right? He's the 21st century Bond, which makes him very different than what Ian Fleming writes. Lazenby finds that happy medium. Lazenby was just a woman. He's still to the day I talked to him and he was still in 2017 making the most sexist, misogynistic remarks. And that's who he was as a person.
Wow.
So he really, and you kind of have to chuckle at it because he's who he is. But he was also a huge guy that you wouldn't want to actually get in a fight with. And so I think Lazenby is the most like what Ian Fleming envisioned Bond. Now, I personally think Daniel Craig is the most entertaining of the Bonds. Those movies by far the best, in my opinion, mainly because I always kind of gauge my Bond fandom or my spy fandom as who would I be afraid of running into in a dark alley? Mm-hmm. And Connery, of course, you're a little bit fear. He was Mr. Universe, but his attitude and his quips and stuff just stopped me from taking him seriously.
Right.
Whereas, you know, certainly I'm not worried about Timothy Dalton or Roger Moore in a dark alley. But, you know, Daniel Craig, I feel as though I would be bloodied at the end of that. Yeah, so that's how I gauge that.
Do you have any favorites, like who your vote would be for the next Bond? Because that's a big subject of interest right now.
I thought they just chose Aaron Taylor Johnson. Is that his name?
Oh, did they? Let's see. Well, I'm gonna Google this.
He was in Bullet Train, and then
it says he is 2 days ago. He is bored of being asked about Bond. Are you sick of being asked the question? But it sounds like the rumors are.
I think Eon has asked him. Eon Productions is the production company that does Bond. Has offered it to him, so he may or may not say yes. He's stupid if he doesn't. But I feel like he is the front runner for the next Bond.
Yeah, I feel like Henry Cavill has been up for this a little bit. But, like, I don't know. I mean, I feel like, you know, Aaron Taylor Johnson, just so people remember here, I'm looking up his – he is known for Nocturnal Animals. So he was in Nocturnal Animals. Okay. He was in the Kick-Ass movies. Bullet Train.
He was in Bullet Train.
The Kingsman. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So he's very athletic.
He was in Tenet. Don't hold that against him. All right. Yeah, I could see it. Yeah, potential.
He has the size. He has the English. Like when he's clean shaven, he looks very British. MI6.
Yeah,
I think he could pull it off. Now, I wanted them to go with a woman.
Oh, interesting.
Well, I've always been they've kind of gone against this lately with the last couple, but I've always been in the I think the great way to explain it is that James Bond is a code name, essentially a cover name,
that it doesn't have anything to do with the gender of the character,
And it's not the person. It's you become 007, you become James Bond when you become 007.
Oh, yeah, right.
And so they could easily fix that and say it's Jane Bond or whatever, and you could actually have a woman play that role, which I think would toss it on its head.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem the way Eon Productions is going.
Yeah, I was pulling for Idris Elba, but I'm just a big Idris Elba fan. So
I think he's too old.
I think he's too old now.
Yeah, I think he's too old. I think that's the problem with him. I mean, he would be fantastic. But I think you really, if you're going to kind of reboot it with a new Bond, you need somebody that I think is younger than that.
All right. Well, when they picked a new Bond, maybe we need to get you and maybe like John Cypher and some other people who are spy movie watchers on, and we'll do a little conversation of like who we would have picked and do we like it. But in the meantime, everyone go out and get Covert City, The Cold War, and The Making of Miami by Vince Houghton and Eric Driggs. Vince, it's a great book. It's a really, really fun and lively read. I have not spent much time in Miami, and I feel like I was in Miami reading the book. It comes to life. So folks should check it out. And thanks for coming back on the podcast and talking to us.
Yeah, the only way to read that correctly is inside a sauna. Then you can really feel like you're in Miami.
With a little Cuban coffee on this.
Yeah, a little gasoline on the side. Yeah, thanks, Shane, so much.
Great to see you, Vince. Thanks.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter @ThatWasChatter.